The other week, we had a discussion about surprises, and Pete Billingham was facilitating the discussion, which he often does. And he was telling us about some of the occasions when he has surprised his family quite deliberately. Some of it was absolutely mind-boggling, the kind of things he's got up to, and it was hilarious to hear the stories. And then we were invited to share about occasions when we've been surprised by something. Some of the stories were funny, some of them were embarrassing, some of them were deeply moving. Jill and I remembered an occasion when she and her sort of little prayer triplet in a first church where I was a pastor prayed just at the end, almost as an aside, "Lord, please do something to surprise us." And the following day, one of our eldest son's friends popped his head into the chapel, having been to youth club, and said, "Oh, I think I'll come here on Sunday with my mum." And they did, out of the blue, and came thereafter for many, many years. And Anita and Roy shared about a time when they were in Africa and witnessed a couple, an elderly couple, receive their sight after being prayed for. And how wonderful was that? The opening chapters of the Gospels are full of surprises. Last week, Paul looked at the story of Zechariah and Elizabeth, and the angel coming to Zechariah when he was in the temple and telling them that they'd have a son and that they were to call this son John. Then, of course, there's the surprise visit of another angel to Mary and to Joseph in a dream, telling them that they are going to be the ones who look after Messiah. There's a picture of Joseph and Mary here as well, hopefully. Thanks, Neil. What did it mean for each of those people to prepare for the promise that they'd received? How did they prepare, and what can we learn from them? What did it mean for Zechariah to prepare for the birth of the son that he'd given up hoping for? Paul said something last week that I'd never heard before or thought before. With reference to the question, or Zechariah's question, how can I be sure of this? If you're not familiar with the story, basically Zechariah is a priest, a high-ranking priest in the temple. He goes in for this special service, which happens once a year, to offer prayers for the people. And the angel says, "You and your wife are going to have a son, and he's going to be the one who prepares the way for Messiah." And Zechariah, quite understandably, says, "Well, how can I be sure of this? Basically, I'm an old man. My wife and I are past the age of childbearing. How can I be sure?" And the angel says, "Because you've doubted, you will not be able to speak until the baby's born and you have named him John." And as Paul said last week, it does seem a bit harsh. It's a perfectly reasonable question. When Mary asks a similar question, "How can I have a baby when I've never slept with a man?" the angel just explains it. She doesn't get told off. But Paul suggested last week that actually, rather than seeing it as a punishment, we should see it rather as a sign of God's grace, that Zechariah had something to rely on as he waited for this promise to be fulfilled. And that really set me thinking, and as the week's gone on, I've been thinking more and more about this and ended up with a sermon today that I wasn't planning to preach, which is always encouraging for a preacher. It was perhaps a discipline, maybe along the lines of Proverbs chapter 3, verse 12, where we read, "The Lord disciplines the one he loves, as a father, the son in whom he delights." So maybe we can see it in that light. When you think about it, being unable to speak was a daily reminder for 40 weeks that this encounter with a heavenly messenger was real and that the promise he'd received would be fulfilled. I was thinking about this, as I said, over the week, and this discipline of being silent for 40 weeks. Richard Foster, in his classic book, The Celebration of Discipline, talks about the fact that speech is one of the things, one of the main ways in which we control what goes on around us. It starts when we're babies. We can't actually form words, but when we cry out, things happen. Mum comes, we get fed, nappy change, it's brilliant. And so we learn to make a noise, and we carry on doing that right through our lives, and we use speech to manipulate people and organize people around us and get things done the way we want them. But it also involves us in what's happening around us, being able to speak and take part in a conversation. One of the patients at Primrose Hospice, where I'm chaplain, is unable to do more than whisper at the moment because of the way the cancer has affected his vocal cords. And he's finding it really difficult in the day room to participate in the conversation. It comes on a particular day when there's always lots of banter, lots of laughter, lots of fun. And he's enjoying it very much, but he's frustrated because he just can't get involved in the conversation. He can only whisper. And we're looking at ways in which perhaps we can amplify his whisper so that he can take part. But if you have an impairment of one of your senses, particularly something like your speech or your sight or your hearing, then you'll understand how that makes you feel rather limited. My mum, her hearing was really down for the last few years of her life, and it was frustrating, not just for her, but for us as well. But she often tended to withdraw from conversation and not take part because she couldn't, frankly, hear what was going on. Similar things happen with people who can't see very well. People are laughing about something that's happened over there, but they've not seen it, so they don't know what it is and can sometimes feel isolated as a result. One step back, one step removed, waiting perhaps for someone else to show them something. How did Zechariah prepare to receive the promise? Elizabeth would have known that she was pregnant. She would soon enough have known that. And for her, the time of preparation happened on just about every level. Spiritually, her understanding of what God could do had been transformed. Psychologically, she would have adjusted to new circumstances, thinking about what it was going to be like to be a mother, realizing that people now looked at her in a different way. Up until then, people knew Elizabeth to be a godly, upright woman and Zechariah a godly, upright man. But, you know, there must be something wrong. Otherwise, why can't she have children? That's how people thought back then. Thankfully, that's not how people think now. But people would start to look at Elizabeth in a different way. Emotionally, preparing for motherhood, perhaps a growing love for the unborn child, and the ups and downs that come with the hormones that do whatever they do when you're pregnant. And physically, all that goes with pregnancy. But what about Zechariah? Zechariah was silent. He just sat quietly, one step removed, holding back, waiting. Presumably, Zechariah couldn't fulfill his normal duties. He was a priest, so people would come to him for advice and counsel. Well, not much use if you can't say anything. He wouldn't be able to pursue say the usual liturgies in the temple. He wouldn't be able to read from the book of the law. This was a season of waiting and praying and trusting. How did it feel for Zechariah? If, as Paul suggested last week, being unable to speak was less a punishment and more a sign of grace, then did Zechariah receive it that way? Well, Luke doesn't tell us in his gospel how Zechariah felt. He might have felt that this was an unfair punishment. He might have been angry and resentful at the limitations that were placed on him. But if he received it as a discipline, as an opportunity to grow in grace, then perhaps his response was rather different. And I think his response was different, because when he names John as his son, a name that no one was expecting, and he's able to speak again, he bursts out in this amazing song of praise to God that I think is a sign that those 40 weeks were not wasted. Let's read them together. I've arranged it responsively. This is Luke chapter 1, verses 68 to 79. And if you could read the words that are in the bold yellow type, that would be great. And remember, this is a song of praise, of exaltation before God. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who has come to his people and set them free. He has raised up for us a mighty Savior, born of the house of his servant David. Through his holy prophets, God promised of old to save us from our enemies, from the hands of all that hate us, to show mercy to our ancestors, and to remember his holy covenant. This was the oath God swore to our father Abraham, to set us free from the hands of our enemies, free to worship him without fear, holy and righteous in his sight, all the days of our life. And you, child, shall be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his way, to give his people knowledge of salvation by the forgiveness of all their sins. In the tender compassion of our God, the dawn from on high shall break upon us to shine on those who dwell in darkness and the shadow of death, and to guide our feet into the way of peace. Beautiful, wonderful words, sometimes referred to as the Benedictus. And if you're in the Church of England, you'd say this every morning as part of morning prayer between the scripture readings and the prayers of intercession. Many people in the scriptures have a wilderness or desert experience. It's often 40-something. For Jesus, he would spend 40 days in the wilderness prior to commencing his ministry. Zechariah spent 40 weeks on silent retreat. My sister-in-law has surprised us all by going on silent retreats. She's one of the most talkative people we've ever known. But she's found great spiritual growth through going on silent retreats for a whole week, not saying anything out loud, apart from perhaps just a short time each day with a spiritual guide. But it seems to me Zechariah has 40 weeks of silence, losing the ability to talk and living with the limitations that placed upon him. And facing our limitations is part of what we all have to deal with in life when we are faced with difficulties, whatever they might be. Perhaps it's an illness. Perhaps it's a change of circumstances where we find ourselves out of our depth and having to adjust. Perhaps it's an accident. Perhaps it's getting older. If you're a sports person, you're past your best by about 30, aren't you, in most sports? So don't think it's just those of you who are over 70 who are getting older. We're all getting older once we've passed about 30. At 56, I'm well on the way. We might face criticism, which kind of undermines our parameters, how we understood our situation and our abilities. We might face disappointment when perhaps somebody lets us down. A feeling of betrayal, even, or rejection. Or it could be physical pain that stops us doing all the things we want to do, or maybe a bereavement. Whatever these may be for us, they're all a form of loss. They're all reminders of our limitations. And at Primrose, I've observed that's the hardest thing it is for people to come to terms with when they have a life-limiting illness. Uppermost in their mind is not the question, is there life after death? It's not, what's the meaning of my life? What's it all about? It's, I'm really struggling because I can't do all the things I used to do. And how do we respond? How do I respond when I'm faced with that loss and that sense of my own limitations? Some people grit their teeth and become stony-faced and appear grumpy or lash out verbally or even physically because they resent the limitations that they face. Others of us crumble inwardly and we may become tearful or just withdraw and wish we could run away from whatever or whoever it is that's causing the problem. Now, I can't be sure that Zechariah embraced the limitations placed on him, but I'm pretty convinced that he did. And he grew spiritually during those 40 weeks ahead of bursting out with that Benedictus. It's a book I read about 3 years ago called Emotionally Healthy Spirituality by Peter Scazzaro, a US pastor, in which he talks a lot about the gift of limitations. The gift of limitations. Scazzaro talks openly about a personal crisis in his life which nearly led him to leave the ministry. He was burnt out. His family life was in tatters. And his church was stretched to breaking point by being too busy and pulled in too many directions. And one of the key things he learned was the gift of limitations. Much of the book relates to the pressure that we often feel as Christians to work harder, to do more, to be busy, busy for the sake of God's kingdom. It's especially true of ministers and church workers, but not only us. As Christians, we often feel that we should be doing more, and we often feel guilty that we're never doing enough. But you know, Jesus himself faced limitations. That's partly what the well-known passages in John chapter 1 and Philippians chapter 2 are all about. The one who is with God and is the same as God, who was in very nature God, became flesh and accepted human nature, human limitations, and even the death humans die. He didn't heal every sick person in Palestine. He didn't feed all the hungry people there. But we find it so hard to accept that there's only so much we can do and there are only so many hours in the day. I have my limitations. You all know that. My wife knows it even better than you do. Some of it relates to the person I am, my personality, my temperament, my gifts, my physical, emotional, and spiritual capacity. Thinking physically and emotionally, I need a certain amount of sleep. And I feel better if I exercise regularly. But both those things actually take time. I had to choose between certain things if I'm going to actually make those happen. The thing is, I'm also happier and I have more energy and I think I'm more effective when those basic things are in place. So am I willing to accept my limitations, that I'm not Superman, and actually discover the freedom and the delight in living within my capacity? I can apply it to something else. Some of you know I play guitar and sing. And over the years, I've looked and listened to other guitarists, Derek Mitchell being one of them, who plays often on a Sunday. And I've watched these guitarists and I thought, oh, I wish I could play like you. Or I've heard someone sing and thought, ah, if only I had your voice. And I listen to songwriters or read their lyrics and I think, where do you come up with these lyrics and these melodies and all the rest of it? But actually, a couple of years ago, because of my involvement in local folk clubs, I thought, actually, people, some anyway, quite enjoy listening to me sing and play guitar. And some of them actually think I'm quite good. And actually, a local folk club's all right. I'm never going to fill the Royal Albert Hall, but that's okay. That's my limit, but actually, I'm happy with that. I learned something else recently as well. Picture on the screen is a shameless plug for a new CD. Some of you know I've just in the process of releasing to raise money for Primrose Hospice. And we made one 6 years ago. And on that occasion, I really decided who was going to play what on which track and how it was going to be arranged and so on. And everyone said it was a good album. It was a good album. But this time, I just did my bit, played guitar, sang the songs, and then left it to my son over the next 18 months, nearly, to bring in other musicians and arrange the tracks and mix it and produce it. I tell you what, the result is far better than anything I could have done. Sometimes we have to learn that actually accepting our limitations is also the way in which other people are released to use their gifts. We cannot do everything we want or be anything we want. We can, however, be everything that God has made us to become. And that's largely about an inner journey and the healing of our souls. And I believe it's only when we see that that we can deal successfully with loss in our lives. Rereading parts of Scherzero's book recently, I noticed that I'd underlined parts where he talks about loss, which is interesting because I read it before I started working at Primrose. He talks about the fact that limits are behind all loss. We lose our dreams. We lose our routines, our stability in times of transition, and so on. At Primrose, loss of health is obvious. But what folk are also having to deal with is the loss of capacity to do the things that gave them self-worth or pleasure, and lost two of the futures that they'd hoped and planned for. I've been struck a number of times by people in their early 60s who said, we had plans to buy a camper van and go traveling after retirement and it's not going to happen now, and things like that. But they still had that day to live. And they still had the love of family and friends. And I'm grateful for Mike, actually, for reading that last 60 minutes because it fits in so beautifully with this. Follow your dream is a message that we often hear. And as a motivation to learn and grow and hone our gifts, that's great. But what happens when your dreams remain unfulfilled, no matter how hard you try, or when you face the brutal fact that they never will be? Remember I said, we cannot have everything we want. We cannot be anything we want, but we can be everything God has made us to become. Accepting the gift of our limitations is such an important step. But I need to clarify it further, because this is not about saying, just take it easy. Never try to move beyond your comfort zone. I went to a gospel concert on Friday night with Jill, our daughter-in-law, Becca, Tim's wife, was singing in this amazing choir in Bristol. Absolutely fantastic evening. And you knew full well that these people, who were part of this choir and the different musicians who played, really had pushed themselves on and on and on to become better and better and better. And I haven't always done that. And sometimes I've needed a bit of a kick. Our Tim was trying to teach me something on guitar a while back, and I said, oh, I can't play that tune, my hands aren't big enough. He said, Dad, it's got nothing to do with the size of your hands, you've just got bad technique. And he was right. Becker was one of the soloists, but not everybody sang a solo. Only a handful. The rest of them were just part of the choir, which may have been their limit. But I tell you what, the joy in their faces, as part of that choir, as part of what was going on, that enabled those soloists to shine, was wonderful to see. Accepting our limitations isn't saying, don't try to do more than you can and just give up. And it's certainly not saying, this is the way I am, so just lump it. Rather, the emphasis is on growing spiritually and developing emotional maturity. The two belong together so that life is lived to the full. A lady came to see me at Primrose just the other day, whose dearly loved elderly mother is dying from a brain tumor. It was a shock to the family. She was well, doing lots and lots of things, and was taken ill, and they assumed had had a stroke. They discovered, in fact, it was a brain tumor and that she had not got long to live. And this lady shared with me some of the emotional anguish that she and the family are feeling. And the questions she's asking about God and so on. She's not a churchgoer, but she's always believed that there is a God and that he's good and that everything happens for a reason, she said. And now she didn't make any sense of what was happening. And then she kept saying what lots of people do, which is, well, I'm being silly, aren't I? I should just be able to get on with it. In other words, not accept my limitations. And I encouraged her not to push those feelings aside or dismiss those questions of faith, which is a much better way of describing doubt in my book. Instead, to embrace them and accept her limitations. She can't take the tumor away, but she can give her mother what she needs even more. And that's the loving companionship of a daughter on this final journey. She can't go back and say all the things she wishes she'd said to her mother in the past. But she can say them now. I love you, Mum. She can also make sure she tells her husband and her children how much she loves them, rather than putting that off until it's too late. And that's exactly what she has been doing. She can't explain why her mother's life should end this way and how it fits into some kind of predestined divine plan. But she can turn to God and know his loving presence and trust in his creative power that is able to bring beauty from brokenness and peace in the midst of pain and good out of the most horrible circumstances. And she can't go through the door of death with her mother. She said, well, I've heard lots of people say, I want to be with her at the end. I gently pointed out that that quite often doesn't happen. Sometimes people are there at the bedside every waking moment. And then they nip out for a cup of tea, and that's the point at which their loved one leaves this world. Strange how it often happens. And I pointed out to her that I said, you cannot go through the door of death with your mother. Only she can do that. And maybe she wants to be there at the very end to do it on her own. But what you can do is be with her over these weeks as she makes her way towards it. I hope you don't think that I'm in any way playing down the agony of seeing a loved one critically ill or dying, or the pain of losing them when they go. And I also know that we sometimes, often, maybe always, need time to work through the emotions associated with loss. But what I am saying is that if we learn to embrace our loss instead of pushing it away, either by lashing out or running from it, by God's grace and in time, we can discover a new inner freedom to be the person God has made us to become. The quickest way to see the light of a new day is not to chase after the sunset, but to wait in the night for the sunrise. None of us want to face difficulties and sorrow and pain or conflict in our lives. Of course we don't. But if we see these things as a form of loss, and then perhaps we begin to discover within the limitations they impose a new beginning that leads to spiritual growth and greater emotional maturity, then that's beautiful. Years ago, I was challenged by a quotation from Bernard of Clairvaux, the monastic reformer, who lived from 1090 to 1153. And this quotation I still need to hear. He wrote, "If then you are wise, you will show yourself rather as a reservoir than as a canal. For a canal spreads abroad water as it receives it, but a reservoir waits until it is filled before overflowing, and thus communicates without loss to itself its superabundant water. In the church at the present day, we have many canals, few reservoirs." I think Bernard of Clairvaux would say the same today, 900 years later. Prayer, time alone with God, not hiding from him by keeping busy. This is how we prepare our hearts to receive more from God. I said earlier that I need sleep and exercise. I'm always better for them. I also need a daily rhythm of prayer. I'm more content within myself. I'm more confident in ministry. I'm probably too busy not to pray. Scazzera writes in his book, "In a culture as frenetic and inattentive as ours, a slowed down Christian who is a contemplative presence to God and others is an extraordinary gift." Zechariah's silence was a gift of limitation, a sign of grace, to be embraced rather than fought against, and lead to the most exultant praise of God. As we prepare for Christmas, let's accept our limitations as a gift. Everything doesn't have to be perfect. We can't get everything we want, as Hillary Clinton discovered. We can't afford everything either, and we don't need it. There are only so many hours a day and only so many days until Christmas. 20, to be precise. As we prepare for Christmas, let's accept our limitations as a gift and so discern what is really important, not least to give time and love to others. And as we prepare for Christmas, having accepted our limitations, perhaps we might also find that most important of all, there is time to pray. Amen.